Hello, my name is Alexandros Chiotelis. I was a postdoc at the National Observatory of Athens, and I'm going to present you my recent work that I performed together with Panos Boumis, Eva Lefa, and Sander Valch, with the name On the Interaction of Type 1a Supernova Remnants with Planetary Nebula. The previous days, we had the chance to listen to a wonderful introduction by Carles and Wolfgang and Tyron about Type 1a, so I will spend just a few seconds to refresh your memory. We know that this class of supernova is the thermonuclear combustion of carbon oxide white dwarfs. These white dwarfs cannot explode by themselves, so they need a binary companion to accrete its mass, and then trigger. And this process will trigger the explosion. However, the main problem is that we don't know what kind of star is this donor star. And the nature of type 1a remains elusive. Two main paths have been suggested. You have heard that many times, the single degenerate or the double degenerate, or accretors and merders, as Wolfgang nicely introduced this terminology. And since we don't know the real nature, there's a big quest in type 1a community to find evidence about their progenitors. One method is the study of the circumstellar medium that surrounds the explosion center. Which is the basic idea behind this method? We know from the binary evolution theory that different evolutionary paths lead to different mass outflows around the progenitor system, so they modified the Abel medium differently. So subsequently, when the supernova will take place, the blast wave will interact with this modified Abel medium, and this interaction will be reflected at the morphological, dynamical, and emission properties of the resulting supernova remnant. And these properties are something that we can observe. So reversing this logical process, we can say that from nearby observations of supernova remnants, we can get important information about the binary progenitor. And now the question is, do type 1a supernovas interact with circumstellar medium? We heard the very nice talks of Lopez and Badenes the previous days. With following a different procedures, they ended up in the same conclusion, that the ambient medium around type 1a is rather homogeneous, or to be more correct, is not that significantly modified. And saying this word, I have the temptation to use the word that to quote the Greek poet Odysseus Elitis, who was also grew up here in Creta, and said, you will come to learn a great deal if you study the insignificant in depth. So what I'm doing is focusing on this insignificant modification of the circumstellar medium. And indeed, looking closely and focusing on nearby historical supernova remnants, we'll see several peculiarities that cannot be explained by considering a homogeneous interstellar medium around the center. The most classical example is Kepler supernova remnant. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that. We know that it is interacting with a dense circumstellar medium in the northwest and at the center, and the model suggests that it is interacting with an asymmetric AGB bubble. Another example is RCW 86, where first Vink and then Williams et al. And Brucer saw that in order to reproduce what you see, you need an interaction and evolution in a cavity. Then you have Tycho, where first Dakalas and Sevalier, and later me, Jaco and Dacia Conseco, have shown that in order to reproduce the dynamics and the spectra, you need an interaction history with a dense bubble. But apart from the young supernova remnants, we have also the mature one that nicely we like to call them in LMC, where it's a very bright iron cores. This is something you don't expect from mature supernova remnants. And Borgovsky suggests that in order to explain this morphology, you need, again, an interaction history with circumstellar medium. The question is, which is this circumstellar medium? In order to have a proper candidate, you need at least two things to explain. First, its formation should be naturally explained from the binary evolution, from the binaries that leads to a type 1a event. And secondly, this can explain at least some properties of nearby supernova that we do observe. What do you suggest? I guess you can imagine from the title of this talk. We suggest that this circumstellar medium, at least in some cases, are the planetary nebula. Or in other words, that supernova 1a, they are taking place in the center of a planetary nebula. Which is our motivation? There are several reasons. First of all, we know that the progenitors of type 1a supernova are either one white dwarf or two white dwarfs. And according to the stellar evolution theory, the binary system should have involved at least one or two times through the planetary nebula phase. That's good news, because it means that the Supernova 1A planetary nebula scenario can host both the single degenerate and double degenerate evolutionary paths. Other good news is that the planetary nebula, as you can see in this nice image, comes in several flavors. You can see completely different morphologies and kinematical properties, and this is completely aligned with the diversity that we see in supernova 1A and their remnants. But the real boost that we got to get this idea comes a year before by a Nature paper by Santander Garcia, who found at the center of this planetary nebula, this is the image from Arista Host Telescope that we took, the Hennes 2428, they found a double degenerate system with superchandra Sekhar mass. And according to the binary evolution prediction, this system will merge, triggering a supernova 1A explosion. So it's the first time that we have an observational evidence that this scenario can really happen. So since we are going to talk about planetary nebula, let's discuss really briefly what is a planetary nebula. We know that this is happening at the end of the AGB phase. The AGB has almost ejected all of its mass through a dense stellar wind and forming this dense bubble around the system, but then its core starts to contract. The wind starts to be very, very fast and continuous and starts to swept up the AGB wind. So it creates a cavity, and this is the shell of the swept up AGB wind. At the same time, the core is very, very hot, so it produces a lot of ionizing flux, ionizing the neighborhood there, and this is what we see as a planetary nebula. Of course, as we said before, they come in several shapes, and we need more ingredients to add in this toy model in order to explain, like binarity, magnetic fields, and so on. So since we saw what is a planetary nebula, the question is, okay, if indeed a supernova 1A will take place in the center of a planetary nebula, the resulting supernova remnant, how would it look like? And the answer is, it depends. It depends, obviously, from the properties of the planetary nebula, the morphology, the size, and so on, and of course from the time delay between the planetary nebula formation and the final thermonuclear explosion. So in order to begin with, we took the most outstanding example, which of course is Hennes 2428. So we simulated a planetary nebula which looks like that, a bipolar open hourglass, where you can see a lot of concentration at the equatorial plane. And also we considered that the delay between the planetary nebula formation and the final supernova 1A explosion is not significant. So the planetary nebula is still around. To do that, we performed two Drake hydro simulations using the MRVAC code. Since we want to simulate an isotropic wind, to the final outcome to be a bipolar planetary nebula, we use these trigonometrical functions in order to describe the wind, which is placed in the inner boundary of our grid. Initially, we place the AGB wind as the stellar evolution demands. These are the typical values that we use for AGB winds, and the final outcome is a nice H-shaped AGB wind bubble. The next step is to introduce now the fast wind, and since the regime of the cavity is much smaller, we will zoom in the center of this large wind bubble. And as you will see in this animation, the fast wind starts to emanate, and since it confronts an isotropic medium, it also gets an H-shaped structure, as it was the Hennes, with a lot of density concentration at the equatorial plane. So since we have constructed now the general structure of the planetary nebula, the last thing that we have to do is to introduce the supernova in this structure and let it evolve. So we use normal values for the supernova and a power law ejecta with n equal to 7. It's classical and suggested by Roger Chevalier. And it will interact. The cavity is there, it's not visible, but believe me, it's there. So the supernova take place. Initially, it starts to immediately interact with the cavity. After a while, also penetrates the wind bubble. It starts to propagate in the interstellar medium. And you see some characteristics. First of all, you can see here that the Reynolds-Taylor instabilities have a party. And these are formed by the collision of the blast wave with the density wall of the planetary nebula, the border between the fast regime and the AGB wind. Another ingredient also that you will see, especially at the beginning, that is that the supernova remnant has a lot of circumstellar medium at the equatorial plane. And the last thing, you see a very strong Reynolds-Taylor instability that is formed, and by time it starts to push the blast wave and deform it a bit. We will talk about that in detail later. So can we, based on this scenario, explain some properties of nearby supernova? We focused on the most typical example about supernova remnant 1A and circumstellar medium, Kepler. And at this moment, I'm going to have a small historical introduction about modeling of this object. So after the work of Katsuda and later Reynolds, who proved that this remnant is the result of a type 1A explosion, the model starts to appear. First, me, Jakob Wing, and Klaas Huber, based on the chemical composition of the circumstellar medium, the morphology and the dynamics of the supernova remnant, we suggested that Kepler is interacting with an HB wind bubble. Then Williams performed infrared observations and verified this idea of the HB wind bubble. Several months later, Bednaut, together with Carles, published also their work, and they claimed that, okay, this scenario nicely reproduced the dynamics and the morphology. However, if you want, in addition to reproduce the X-ray spectra, then at the center of the wind bubble, you have to add a small cavity, as we listened a few hours ago. And finally, a year later, Berkeley says, yes, but don't forget, but also there is a lot of circumstellar medium at the center of the supernova remnant. So the wind bubble should not be spherically symmetric, but you should have a lot of concentration of mass at the equatorial plane. So everyone was happy, and then the observer came, second of the Hunter, published in 2013, and said, take it easy, guys, such an HB star does not exist at the center of Kepler's supernova remnant. So we have to reconsider and reconstruct. And we need a model that should satisfy all of these theoretical and observational demands at the same time. Does it ring a bell? This is the simulation. Oops. This is the simulation that we got from the planetary nebula formation. We have an HB wind bubble, which can explain the chemical composition of the circumstellar medium. We have the cavity that the work of Bednaut demands. We have also a distribution of the circumstellar medium. So when the supernova remnant will interact, we also will see a lot of circumstellar medium at the equatorial plane. And also this model does not demand a survived HB star at the center of the remnant. Did we model Tycho? The answer is no. But 3D modeling is needed to frame a draw conclusion. But up to now, this is the only scenario, at least, that I can think that can satisfy all of these demands at the same time. And this scenario has an extra bonus, the ears. You know that the Kepler supernova remnant has nice antisymmetric ears, and none of the previous mentioned scenario deal with them. Soccer attempts to explain them using, of course, the jets. And there are two scenarios. First, he considers a planetary nebula, where the jets are formed before the explosion. They penetrate the circumstellar shell, makes ears in the circumstellar medium. When the supernova explodes, it will interact with these ears and also will form ears. The other scenario says that the jets accompany the supernova explosion, so when they collide with the circumstellar shell, also they will form ears. As you already mentioned in our models, we don't need these ingredients. We just need a bipolar planetary nebula, which is the most common morphology of planetary nebula. And then by this collision, you can see that nice ears are formed at the equatorial plane. So we believe that our model has a lot of advantages in comparison with the jet model. First of all, it doesn't need the extra ingredient, the jets. And here where comes the Occam's principle. Also, in our model, the main difference is that the ears are formed in the equatorial plane instead of the poles of the planetary nebula. And this agrees with what we observe in Kepler, where the ears are in the same line where we see this concentrated circumstellar medium at the equatorial plane. If the jet model was correct, the ears had to be in this direction. And finally, if this jet model is correct, it means that the planetary nebula has the same size with the supernova remnant, because it claims that now currently is interacting with the shell of this planetary nebula. That makes a shell equal with the radius of Kepler to be from 2 to 3.5 parsec. This is an extremely large planetary nebula, and very rarely we see so big planetary nebula. So apart from Kepler, the ear formation scenario can be generalized. We don't need necessarily a type 1A, we don't need necessarily a planetary nebula. But when you will see a planet, a supernova remnant, which has ears, like G19-0.3 and the large Hanya supernova remnant, then this is a trace that this remnant has an interaction history with a bipolar circumstellar medium, where the sizes of the ears depends, first of all, on the evolutionary state of the supernova remnant. Here you see an example, and you can see how this radio Taylor stability starts to grow and the ear starts to be bigger and bigger, and also demands, of course, from the geometrical properties of this bipolar circumstellar medium. Here are two extreme examples, where here the radio Taylor stability has slightly deformed the blast wave, while in the most extreme case has completely penetrated the forward shock, creating a jumbo supernova remnant. And the last thing that I want to say, it's a warning from the observers, is look at the kinematics of such a structure. You see that where we have this ear, the Reynolds Taylor stability, the velocities are completely different. While the rest of the pre-shot plasma has a velocity in this example of around 4,000 km per second, what we see here is much higher velocities in the level of 6,000 up to 8,000 km per second. So we have something that looks like a jet, it also moves like a jet, but is not a jet. So what glitters is not gold, what is collimated at fast is not a jet. And this is my summary. So we know that planetary nebula seems promising candidates of the circumstellar medium because they can explain easily by the binary evolution theory, actually demands to have planetary nebula, and also can explain the supernova remnants 1A diversity. A planetary nebula with the properties of Hennis 2428 seems a very promising progenitor of the circumstellar medium which surrounds Kepler supernova remnant, because it bridges all of the demands of the theory and observations. It explains the composition and the distribution of the circumstellar medium. It's aligned with the demands of the X-ray spectra. It has the cavity, and it also explains nicely the ear formation without adding by hand extra ingredients. Of course, in order to draw a firm conclusion, we need a 3D modeling, which I hope till the end of the month to have a proper answer. And finally, about the ears, is that we see that supernova interacting with revealing antisymmetric lobes is a trace that it has an interaction history with a bipolar circumstellar structure, and this is also applicable for core collapse supernova. And the main difference with the jets is that these ears are formed in the equatorial plane of the progenitor system. That's all. Thank you very much.
Nice talk. I just had a quick question.
Yeah.
How realistic is it that the time delay would be that short? I mean, typically we're talking giga-year time scales, at least for the white dwarf to accrete its mass. I mean, if this was a very common channel in these weird 1As, that would tell you that these progenitors are all somehow coming from rather large main sequence stars, such that the white dwarfs don't need much mass to accrete to cross the threshold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're totally right on that. Indeed, this model to be valid, you need a small time delay. And we know from the double degenerate models that it's quite a slow process, is what is happening, and also the single degenerate. First of all, the planetary nebula is not necessarily to be formed by the primary white dwarf. It can be formed by the secondary. And then also Soccer's model, the core degenerate, can be applicable. Or other alternatives is, for example, the edge detonation models. So you don't need to accumulate the mass from the white dwarf, so you trigger an explosion at the edge, so you can have. And these are also the good news, because it is true that we don't observe circumstellar medium in all of the supernova 1A. So what we have to do if we want to test this model is to compare the time that is needed in order to dissipate a planetary nebula with the predictions of population synthesis and see how many then we expect. So we have two things in order not to see the circumstellar medium. The time delay, as you already mentioned, and also the orientation. Because talking about bipolar circumstellar structures, also the orientation plays an important role on what I will see at the end.
Thank you.
This is extremely exciting work. So, I mean, you know, to comment on what Luke said, I mean, I think there's nothing single degenerate about this. This is just a merger within the planetary nebula that then explodes, and you see exactly what you see. So my question is, have you simulated how long time has to pass until you get a completely circular supernova remnant? Because most of the type 1a supernova remnants are circular, so I think you just need to wait until, like, you know, the planetary nebula expands, and then you will get our normal supernova remnant. Or if you merge very quickly, you will get something like Kepler. But the question is, how long would that work out with the fraction of symmetric to asymmetric 1a supernova remnants?
Yeah, I would say the favorite. First words when you are talking about theory, which is it depends. So let's talk generally. I would say that when the supernova remnant will start to approach the set-off phase, then it starts to lose information about what happened in the past. So the set-off is quite a general limit that we can say how long it takes for the supernova remnant as a time scale to maintain this information. But also it depends on the density contrast, is very important, between the circumstellar bubble and the interstellar medium, and the geometry. Actually, it depends very strong on the ratio between the density and the equatorial plane and this on the poles. So, yeah, but I hope I will have... this is what I had in mind, but I hadn't the time, is to study also the mature supernova remnants that we see in several cases to see if indeed they can maintain such a structure for long.
Vikram had his hand up first.
I guess I was going to follow up on what these people were saying also. This thing about, so if you, in order to get a white dwarf and then to get a supernova to explode, your star has stopped giving off a wind. The moment it stops giving off a wind, your planetary nebula is not going to remain in the same shape that it was like that for thousands of years, because it's going to start to dissipate very clearly. You're never going to get those nice bipolar lobes just standing there for a million years until the supernova or the white dwarf explodes. So you're not going to get easily these shapes actually when the supernova explodes. By then it should dissipate, it should go, you should have a much thinner wall. I mean, if you carry on the planetary nebula simulations for a long time, you will see this, especially if you stop feeding the wind because there's nothing feeding it anymore. So you wouldn't get all this stuff in reality. I mean, you have assumed that you have a planetary nebula, it expands to that point and then the white dwarf explodes, but that's of course not true.
Yeah. Okay, we are going to the field of the binary evolution theory, and it's not really my field. I can make a lot of speculation.
No, but it has nothing to do with the evolution theory. You just have a nebula which is not being fed anymore.
Yeah, but I'm making just a simple, I'm just putting the piece of the puzzle together, what is needed and what is the structure that we do demand. And it's not only about the supernova remnants, it's also about the supernova, that the early phase, that we see initially that the supernova is interacting with a cavity, but also we see these blue shifty time variable cells, absorption lines, the sodium lines of Patak, which means you have a cavity, and around the cavity you have a cell. This really reminds me a planetary nebula shape. Someone can say, yeah, okay, it can be symbiotic nova. It's also true that you can create these multiple cells. But a symbiotic nova, again, leaves a giant donor star back, and then Wolfgang also will start to complain.
No, I'm saying forget the stellar evolution. That's not the important. The important thing is you just stop feeding the nebula. Once you stop doing that, you will not maintain these shapes and these kind of nice structures. That's all. It's a simple argument besides the evolution theory.
Okay.